All right, welcome to class today. I am Luther Tykonovich. I am filling in for Charles Rice. Well, he is at a conference. I'm not used to teaching in this room. Is the volume good? Too loud? Too quiet? Any comments on volume? Okay. I understand you just had a quiz. I understand it had a pretty low average. I haven't actually looked at the quiz before, but if we want to talk about the quiz, we can. Is there any questions in particular people want to talk about the quiz? Where am I? Yes? Can we go over number six? Let's find out what number six is. Never seen it before, but I'm sure it'll make sense once we look at it. Well, maybe not. All right. All right, so we have three big arrays of a million elements each. And we're looping over some of the elements. Okay. So the outer one just has a simple pair of loops. The third one has a triple of loops, where one of them goes up by 16 and the other one does the remaining bits. And then we're asked about temporal locality. All right. Somebody describe to me what temporal locality means. Yes? It's accessed now, it'll be accessed later. Okay? So we want to see that there's some element repeatedly accessed between these two loops. In particular, accessed in a short period of time. So we don't want a long gap. It's not simply enough to access it multiple times. We need to access it close together in time. So half of you got this right. Somebody, since I haven't spent any time looking at this, point out to me where the temporal locality is better. Yes? The second function for what? For two? Oh, foo two. Yes, I agree it has better temporal locality. Why? What memory access does repeat? Yes? Yeah, so let's see if we can illustrate what you just said. All right, so you're saying let's look at A. If we consider one run through the innermost loop, the first run through the innermost loop will go 0 through 15. Okay? Then the next thing this will do, the next thing, J will go up to 1, and it will go 1 through 16. 15 of those 16 iterations will have pretty good temporal locality. But to notice it has better temporal locality than the other, we have to verify that isn't the case in this one. So what does this one do? This one goes 0 through 1024, and then it goes 1 through 1023, and then 1 through 1024. It does repeat, but there's 1,000 extra accesses between the first and the second set of repetitions. So we're accessing the same things, but we're accessing them with much greater temporal lag. Yes?
Isn't that very interesting? Because I think temporal locality only looks if you are accessing the same thing, but like it may have like a better spatial locality, but like temporal.
Well, we'll get to spatial locality, but I've only talked about accessing, let's consider A sub 1. A sub 1 is accessed by both loops twice. In the first loop, they're accessed 1,000 iterations apart. In the second loop, they're accessed 16 iterations apart. So the temporal locality of those two accesses to the same memory is better in the second loop because there's less time that's elapsed. Other questions? All right, we had an implied question here about the spatial locality, which I'm guessing? No, I'm wrong. All right. Spatial locality. They only have spatial locality about C listed here. So spatial locality means that we access nearby references of memory repeatedly. Not about the same one over and over again, but about one and then one that has a small difference in address. And typically, spatial locality also implies temporal locality. So we need to access something that's nearby soon. Accessing something nearby a long time from now won't generally be considered spatial locality. And the argument here is that they're making is let's consider C's as temporal spatial locality. So we look at our C accesses. Again, the thing that differs is what's going around the innermost loop. So on this one, the innermost loop is doing 0 through 15, and then it is doing 1024 through 1039, and so on. Huh. Oh no, I did the math wrong, didn't I? Oops. Alright, so this one, I did the J instead of the I. So this one, the inner loop is going 1024, and then it's going to 2048. That's right, it's going 0, 1024, 2048, up to 16 times 1024. And then it's going to loop back around and do 1, 1025, 2049, up to 16 times 1024 plus 1. Okay? Whereas this other loop simply goes 0, 1024, up to... It by 1024 is up to 1024 squared. And then it's going to come around again to 1025 up to 1024 squared plus 1. And so if we look at the second loop, the 17th iteration is right next to the first. 17 is small enough, we expect it to fit in the cache. And so we expect that value to still be around because we're spatially local. 0 and 1 are spatially local. We're accessing relatively close together. In the first one, however, we've loaded 1,000 things in between, plus whatever we're loading for the others. And so by the time we get back to 1, we're unlikely to still find it in the cache. Question?
Doesn't the first one feel like 0, 1,
2, 3, 4? You're absolutely right. I did the math wrong again. Look at me. All right. I'm doing a marvelous job of this, aren't I? Yes. This goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. It just goes on up. It goes up to 1024 squared. Thank you. I should read the code before answering the question. So which one has better spatial locality now? Number one. Hopefully that's the key. If it's still not the key, then I probably still don't understand what's happening here. Yes, it is. Hooray! And we mostly got that. Good job. All right. Other questions? Yes?
Can you go over question 5?
Can I go over question 5? I can certainly try. There is something up above this. What's the thing up above this? Ah, so much stuff. All right. I'm going to trust you to tell me if it mattered.
Okay.
Consider the following C code. We're looping over an array, adding things to the array. How many cache misses would occur in a 1 kilobyte fully associative cache with 64 byte cache blocks and an LRU replacement policy and write allocate write back policy? So many things about the cache. Hooray. So we have two loops. So we're going to have to think about each of them separately, as you will see happens here. Okay. I have actually no idea what these 0, 1,000, 2,000s mean. Does anybody know what his key means? Yeah. Plus equals 1,000. Thank you. I didn't notice that at all. All right. So, shouldn't we have, all of the misses the first time? There must be something up here that tells me that or not. Nothing up there applies to question 5? All right. How many cache misses? So the first loop checks 0, 1,000, and 2,000. Those are going to be, we have a 1 kilobyte cache with 64 byte cache blocks. So I'm expecting all of those to be misses. right? So I'm going to get three misses there. So let's do this. So I have 0, 1,000, 2,000, all of which miss. This next loop is then going to access 0, 990, 1980, and that's it, right? Okay, so now I need to figure out, I know 0, as long as I have at least 3 lines in my cache, I do, right? How many lines are in my cache? I have 64-byte blocks with a 1024-byte cache. So 1024 divided by 64 gives me how many cache lines? 16 lines. 16 lines. And it's fully associated with least recently used. So I just need, so I'm only accessing 3 things, 5 things. I'm not going to have to worry about swapping things out. Now, there's no conflict misses in a fully associative cache. So 0 is definitely in the cache, because it's the same address I accessed recently. 990. Now for 990, I need to figure out, is it in the same cache block as something I've accessed before? So 990 is only 10 away from 1,000. So it's close enough to be within a 64-byte cache block. But the question is, do they actually overlap? Remember, the way we align our cache blocks are aligning them on power of 2 boundaries. And so I need to figure out what power of 2, or multiple of 64 boundary, rather, 1,000 and 990 happen to lie in. I know that 1024 is going to be a 64-byte boundary. And so I can try subtracting 64 from that to get 9, the 0, and subtract the 6. That's going to give me 60. And so this is one cache block. Yes?
Is 64-byte block, how are you putting 64 things in it?
These are bytes. I'm doing byte addresses here. But this is a good point. These are ints. Is it ints? It's character? It's a character array, yes. So they're each 1 byte long, so I don't have to deal with any kind of squishing. If those were shorts instead, then I have a half-width number of shorts in my block and have to do the math accordingly. Now, of course, it's not. It's possible that the array does not start at the beginning of a block, which makes this question seem a little odd to me. Oh, he does up at top. All right, huzzah. There is so much information. All right. So this is going to be a hit, and then we do the same math here for 2,000. And it says here that it's going to be a miss. I can go through the math if anybody wants me to. All right. Other questions? Yes? Can I go over 4? I can certainly try. A direct mapped 256-byte cache of 64-byte blocks, write allocated, write back policy, how many cache misses will occur? Notice that unlike the examples in lecture, these axes are unevenly distributed across the sets of the cache. All right, so again, I'm going to need to figure out what my cache actually looks like. I have a 256-byte cache with 64-byte blocks. So that means I've got 4 lines in my cache. Exactly 4 lines. For a total of 256. And I know, because it's direct mapped, I can tell you, for any access you make, I can compute exactly which line it has to hit. I simply need to take the modulo 256 and divide by 64. Okay, so let's consider, oh my, I'm not sure, we'll come back to the I loop, which doesn't seem to be doing anything with, that's because it's going to cause us to have hits the second time through, perhaps. All right, so the first time through, everything has to miss. Because the first time through, it's a cold cache, and I'm moving one at a time. So never mind, not everything will miss. And this is a chart character array. So the very first access will be to address 0. That will be a miss. And then I'm going to hit the next 63 things, because they're going to walk down this line. Right, so I'm going to have 1 miss, and I'm going to have 63 hits. Then my next pass through, sorry, then I'm going to hit my next line. So when I hit 64, I'm going to have a miss. And I'm going to go up to 127, having another 63 misses, hits rather. And then I'm going to go up to 128, up to 192, giving me one more miss, and 63 more hits. I'm not done yet, because from 192, I need to go up to 255, giving me, yet again, a bunch more misses and hits. But now I have the wrapping around. I'm going to go all the way up to 280. So when I come back up here, I'm going to evict this whole line in order to make room for a new line. And so I'm going to have a miss at 256. And then I'm going to go up to 279. So I'm going to have my fifth miss. And then I'm going to have those remaining hits. How many is that? That's 23? 22? 23? Something like that. Right? And now I think about the next iteration. The remaining nine iterations are all going to be the same. The remaining nine iterations are going to do this, going to have to evict the first line and reload it, but they're going to hit on the second, third, and fourth line. Everything will be hits. Question?
So, if we have five misses for each inner loop, then there are 10 other loops, right? Why don't we just...
I'm not going to get five misses for each inner loop. The second time through the inner loop, I'm only going to have two misses. Why will I only have two misses the second time through the inner loop? Yeah. Yeah, what, 64, 128, and 192. They haven't been evicted. They're still in the cache. So the second, third, fourth, etc. time through the inner loop, I'm going to miss on 0 and miss on 256. Both in the first cache line, which is going to have this conflict that's going to keep swapping back out. Yeah? Right, so remember how a direct map cache works, right? We have an index, we have a tag, which I've just completely ignored, and we have the value. I didn't really ignore the tag, I just used it without mentioning it. Where did I use the tag? What's the tag's purpose? Yeah? Exactly, differentiate between 0 and 256, right? They're going to have different tags. How do I know they're going to have different tags? Because I'm going to take the address, and I'm going to chop its bytes apart. I'm going to have the block offset in the lower order bytes. How many bytes do I need? I need enough to distinguish between 64 values. Right? So I'm going to need to have 6 bits down here in order to distinguish between 64 values. Then my block index is going to be 2 bits. That's going to give me my, sorry, that's my tag, yeah, so my index, and then the rest of this is my tag. And so if we look at 256, 100000, right? We notice I got the tag of 1, where the other one got the tag of 0. Now, it probably actually won't be a tag of 1 and a tag of 0, because whatever the array's base index will also be in the tag, right? So we'll also have whatever the array is here, and then the 1, right? Or 0. But it'll be the same each time through because the array is not changing address. Other questions? All right. So, as I understand last class, you left off talking about how to use caches to make code more efficient. But I wasn't super clear on exactly where you left off. Did you talk about cache blocking? Yes, we talked about cache blocking. No, that's a new term to me. Okay. Then let's explain cache blocking. Here I have a little animation of matrix multiply. I am animating what gets accessed over time. We can speed it up because this is going to take a long time. Hey, this is how the loops work. And I understand you've seen matrix multiply several times before, but I might be wrong. And you may want to ask questions about this code before I move on. Okay. So we have this code. It's doing a lot of memory accesses to perform matrix multiply. Before we talk about making anything better, if we have cache-based problems, if we're going to get cache misses, which of the three matrices is most likely to get misses? Yeah. One on the far right. Why do you say that? Yeah. So let me pause this. Right, so where do our cache blocks lie? Our cache blocks are going to be stored horizontally, assuming we have a row major matrix, which I understand is the kind of matrices you've been dealing with. Okay? So all the values in a row will be right next to each other in memory, and when I get over here to the end, that's going to wrap around down here to finish my block. Unless they happen to align with the width of the table. So that means each of these things on my right-hand side, I expect to be in a distinct cache block. Unless my cache blocks are really big or my matrix is really small. I'm expecting each of those to be in a distinct cache block. But when I look over here, I expect these to be a whole bunch in a cache block, and I'm also not changing them very much. So I got good temporal locality and good spatial locality for that matrix. And this matrix, it basically doesn't matter. I've got perfect temporal locality. I access the same memory address over and over and over and over and over again until I'm done with it and then never come back. There is no room for more spatial locality because I have perfect temporal locality on that side. And even beyond that, when I do move on, I actually also have spatial locality when I finally move on to the next thing. So my destination matrix is just fine. There's nothing I can do with the destination matrix. It's as good as we can get. The left-hand matrix is pretty good. As long as I can fit a whole row in cache, however many blocks that is, I'm going to expect to get pretty much all cache hits there. But my right-hand matrix, that's going to be the problem. Because each of those accesses is going to be in a different cache line. Now, it might be okay. If I can fit enough lines to completely cover the matrix all the way down, then I'm going to have pretty good cache locality. Not great, but pretty good. I'm going to end up hitting each of the elements in those lines as I loop back around, right? And I'll have to reload one occasionally once I get to sort of the end of the line, but I'll get sort of a fairly good number of hits. But the problem comes if I don't have that many lines. If I can't store all of those lines, then in order to load this one that's just been accessed, it had to evict some of the older ones. Which means I'm going to get miss forever. If my cache isn't big enough. And getting a cache miss on every iteration of my inner loop is going to cause quite a large slowdown. Depending on which cache I miss in, a few cycles to a few hundred cycles per iteration. So it's going to cause a fairly large, potentially hundredfold slowdown of my overall code. Questions about the problem before I talk about the solution? Yes?
I guess this is all within the context of like a naive approach to matrix multiplication.
This is the code I am using. We're going to make the code fancier to make things faster. Or make the code fancier by making it something you would never write in a software engineering course. That's a common trend of optimization. Other questions before we start going into that? All right. So what can we do to our code to try to get better locality on my right-hand cache, my right-hand matrix? Thing I need to do is stop it from accessing every row before it comes back around. Once I load a cache line in, I want to make sure I come back and use it before it gets lost. This is the basic idea of cache optimization. Once you load something into cache, use it a lot before it gets swapped out. Try to optimize its usage. And so I don't want to look at every single row before I come back. And so I can solve this by tweaking my code. Let's explore how. On my right-hand cache, my row is given the index I. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to chop I into chunks. Let's do it first in a rather silly-looking way. So I'm going to make another variable I'm going to call II. And I'm going to have it go up by, how about by 4? And then this one is going to start at II and go up to II plus 4. Here is my strange change to my code. Chat with whoever you're sitting next to. See if you can figure out, have I changed the behavior in any way? If not, great. If so, how have I changed the behavior? How is this code different than the code before? I'm about to rerun this with the new code. I want you to commit. I don't care if you commit to me, but I want you to commit to yourself. Thumbs up if it's exactly the same access pattern, everything's exactly the same. Thumb down if something has changed. Exactly the same, up, down, something has changed. All right, let's go find out. Has anything changed? And yet most of you thought something had changed. Why? Why has nothing changed? What's going on here? My outer loops clearly haven't changed because I didn't do anything to them at all. My inner loop used to go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now it goes 0, 4, 8, 12. But the loop inside goes 0, 1, 2, 3, and then 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8, 9, 10, 11. That's the same order of accesses. It still goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's just this extra loop going around. I've made my code more complicated with no change. This is the opposite of good software engineering. Why would I do this? I would do this because now I can move the loops. I'm going to just take this loop and swap its order with another loop. Let's just swap it here. Boom. Having nested loops in different order should not change the total set of things I ever access. Right? Particularly because I haven't swapped the two that depend on each other, the I and the II, right? So I should have the same values being accessed, I should have the same result of my code in this order. But now we're going to see what happens in our code. All right. So I just swapped the order. But now I'm moving through the matrix in a different way. A lot of things have changed as a consequence. I'm going to end up visiting the same cell in my destination matrix many times now. Because I have going to iterate through the same RC pair multiple times. Whereas I used to just do the same one over and over again, now I'm doing them multiple times. Now I have to start worrying about the locality over here. But my R loop hasn't changed, so this one is going basically the same, but it's going in shorter chunks because its other half has changed. And then this one is doing these like ribbons through the matrix. But they're more temporally, they're more spatially local ribbons. I'm still never accessing the same value twice in a row, but I'm accessing them sort of more spaced out. And so this overall, how will this compare in cache locality? Was this the right swapping to do? What do we think? Assuming I have enough to store four cache lines over here, one cache line over here, and a couple cache lines over here, I'm going to have much fewer misses. Because now, once I load a cache line in, I'm going to use the rest of the entries of the cache line before I evict it. Before, I was using one entry per cache line and then evicting it and then reloading it later. Now I'm going to use all of them, however many there are, by moving across horizontally, as long as I can fit all four of those in my cache. And so I've dramatically increased my cache hit rate. I've reduced my cache, made my cache a little bit more complicated on the other two matrices, but they're still moving essentially in spatially local ways. As long as my cache is big enough, I should be okay. Questions? Yes? Oh, yeah, you know, that probably should be true. It turns out that all I'm doing is doing an animation, though, so it doesn't really matter. And I'm not actually sure my animation parsing code can deal with a plus equals, so we'll leave it at equals for now. I may have just made a typo in making my animation code. All right, this is the basic concept of what we call cache blocking. This is an optimization strategy when we can't find the right order to get high locality. We just add more loops. We take loops and we chop them into chunks and we reorder the loops to try to get more locality. Right? And our general principle is we want to try to use a given cache line many times before it gets evicted. The more times we can use a cache line before it gets evicted, the higher cache utilization we expect to have. We could count actual hits and misses, as you did in the past quiz, with some difficulty, because that's a tedious and complicated thing to do. Rules of thumb, like try to keep using it, will work a lot better. Right? Let's just see one other way we could do this. Let's imagine we do this to everything. So I'm just going to make a duplicate of R that does the same thing we did with I, and we're going to do the same thing with C. All right, and I'll do this with C as well. All right, now this should have exactly the same accesses if I didn't make any typos. I must have made a typo. Where did I make a typo? Oh, thank you. Yes, this should be CC and this should be CC. Thank you. All right. And we're seeing the same pattern we were before. No, we're not. What's going wrong? C equals CC. Thank you. Fix my typos. All right. Hooray. Now we're seeing the same pattern as before. That should be the case. All I did was turn single loops into pairs of loops. But now I can reorder them however I want. Let's just arbitrarily move all of the doubles to the front. What's happening? I see each matrix is loading this little block of the matrix in and accessing that block several times. And so for every block of the left-hand matrix, for every block of the right-hand matrix, for every block of the middle matrix, I am going to do the work I can do with those three blocks. And this is sort of a general strategy that will work for really huge caches. What if I can't even fit a whole row of a really huge matrix? Even if I can't fit a whole row in cache of any one matrix, I can still pick a block size such that the three blocks I am working at a time all fit in cache. Now I'm going to load some of these blocks multiple times. This is not perfect, because matrix multiply is sort of a hard caching problem. But this will scale to gargantuan matrices if I pick the right block size. And all of these fours were just numbers I picked. I can pick any number there I want. So I can make bigger or smaller blocks based on how big my cache is. Now, the exact way you do this in any given problem varies a little bit, but the basic pattern is always the same. I'm going to split a single loop into a pair of loops, one that goes in big steps, one that goes in the small steps in between. And in general, I want to move those big step loops earlier, because I want to take a region of the array and deal with that region, and then deal with the parts inside that region in the inner loop. And this is the idea of cache blocking. Questions? All right, because I also occasionally teach software engineering type courses, let me just say a word. If you're actually going to put this in production code, always put a comment that explains why. Because somebody's going to come along in a code review and say, oh, and they're right. So if you don't explain why you're doing it, then they're going to be confused. It's usually useful to even have in the comment the simple code that you're optimizing. Because people who haven't thought about the optimization are going to be confused what you're doing, let alone how you're doing it. And this is probably something you want to do in your own code too, even if nobody but your future self will read your code. Your future self will forget why you did what you did. So when you apply optimizations that involve complicating the code like this, you want to make sure you have something that records why you did it. All right. This is the end of what I planned to say about caching. Any comments about this? Cache blocking, caching in general, anything I can clarify before we move on to a new topic? Yes?
So if we did, say, optimize doing this, we have to do a separate optimization for every caching style, like implementation for our architecture?
Great question. How much of this would change for direct map versus fully associative?
A lot.
Somebody give me a specific thing that would change. Yeah. Okay. So maybe not much because it's based on size rather than access? Is that a hand or just a stretch? Just a stretch. Yeah, direct map caches add a weird complexity, which means I need to know the actual addresses of everything. If this is a direct mapped cache, a behavior might have different effect if I changed where D was located in memory relative to L and R. And so trying to optimize for a direct map cache is quite tricky. However, practically all caches today are set associative. And they usually have large enough sets that for simple operations like this, I don't need to worry about it. If I happen to have, say, 5 matrices and a 4-way set associative cache, I may occasionally run into conflicts. They're going to be pretty hard to predict. And even in this case, if there happened to be a triple of blocks that all lined up and all hit the same sets in a 2-way set associative cache, I'd pretty soon move to a new set of blocks. And I expect that problem to be, to some degree, transient in this particular code. So usually, we optimize in the simple world of a fully associative cache. And we hope that the cache implementer has made something that's close enough to fully associative that it won't hurt us. If we time it and we realize it did hurt us, then we might come back and try to fix that. And usually what that will look like is we're usually getting pretty good performance, and then there's a spike for one particular layout of memory. And that's usually a sign that our cache layout is causing us problems. And we have to decide if that particular case is important enough to optimize for, or if we just say occasionally you get bad performance. Yes?
You chose 4 here for those outer loops. Is there a general rule for how to choose that number?
I want all of the blocks that result to fit in cache at once. I also did something a little sneaky here. I had a 16 by 16 matrix, and 4 is a divisor of 16. So I didn't have to worry about any extras at the end. If I had a 17 by 17 matrix, there is no block size that I could just use by itself. I would have to have something after this to clean up the extras. Right? And so you'll need to think about that when you're actually implementing it. If I can find something that's a factor of the overall size, great. If I can't find something that's a factor of the overall size, I need to figure out how I'm ensuring that I hit everything once and only once in my looping, which may mean an extra loop at the end, or may mean that this 4 turns into some sort of arithmetic based on some other value and changes in different parts of the block. Other questions? I guess there's one other comment I should make. I want my number to be big enough to fit them all in cache. 1 would clearly work. If I do 1, I'll be back to the original code. 2 will be just a little bit better than the original code. 4 will be better than that. The bigger the number that will fit in cache, the more efficient my overall will be, because the fewer times I have to loop back around. So I want the biggest number that will keep everything in cache will give me sort of my most optimal performance. This is, however, complicated, because which cache? The L1 cache is smaller than the L2 cache is smaller than the L3 cache, and so on. And so if I really, really care, maybe I need many blocks. I have an L3-sized blocking with an L2-sized blocking inside that, with an L1-sized blocking inside that, with my actual work. And whether that will actually give me payoff compared to the extra overhead of running the loop or not will depend somewhat on whether my actions are more compute-bound or more memory-bound. Yes?
When you say you want that 4 to like be a multiple of the cache size, do you mean like the...
I mean the matrix size. Right, because a 16 by 16 matrix, I want a factor of 16 so that I don't have to do extra work. But I can't do that clearly if I had a prime size matrix, so I would have some special extra to handle the extras. Yes?
So you set step size to 16.
Yeah, what would happen if I'd set it to 16? Let's try it. While I'm setting this, what do you think will happen? The whole matrix is one block. So I do that one block. The end. Right? And the same thing will happen if I set this to 1 instead. Then each cell in the matrix is one block. And so I do a one cell block, and then I go on to the next one cell block. And again, I am doing the same thing I was before. But if I pick something in between, like 8, for example, then I will do an 8x8 block, and then the next 8x8 block, and so on. And just for completeness, what if I say we're going up by 5s? Let's see if my simulation can deal with this. I need it to go faster. Right off the edge. Right? Not ideal. In my simulation, that just makes a weird picture. In your real code, this causes memory errors. And so you want to do some size that isn't a factor of the matrix size. You're going to have to handle that fact it's not a factor in some way. Anything else about caching? Okay. Let me stop this from chewing up my CPU while it's in the background. What do we want to do now? All right. We're going to talk about a different optimization strategy now. Here I have a little piece of code. I'm expecting you can look at this code and understand it fairly quickly, although I think I may have different rules about spacing than Professor Rice. Sorry about that. Now this code, let's start by, we've just been talking about caching, talking about its cache locality. Temporal locality, spatial locality, how are we doing? Do we have any temporal locality at all? No, nor any potential for it. We're only trying to access each piece of memory once, so great. Spatial locality, could it get better? Nope. When I access a byte, I'm going to access the next byte next. This is as good as spatial. So I'm caching, I'm great. But it turns out this code is not great in practice. Let's see why. Here is that same code in assembly. Okay? I used my compiler and then cleaned up the labels because, ugh. So what are we doing? We're zeroing out a few variables by XORing them with themselves. Then I have my actual loop. My loop is comparing two values. One of these is an argument. So this would be the length of the, because remember my original code, I had an argument was the base address and an argument that was the size. So I'm comparing this index value I just zeroed out to the second argument, the size. And if it's less than, so I pass the end of the loop, then I jump down to the end of the loop and return. Otherwise, I do this magic right here, which is using our multiple part memory access to do the full memory access I had, right? My value sub I is using the index, the base, sorry, the base, the index, and the size of an element to create a memory access and load it into RAX, but add it into RAX. So I'm doing this. This is the plus equals line here. Increment RDX and go around again. This is my loop. Let's consider the efficiency of this loop. For each piece of work my loop wants to do, the work is done on just this one line. Here is the work. For each piece of work, I run 5 instructions. That is a pretty low efficiency in instructions per unit work. 1 instruction of work for 5 instructions of loop. And so one of our strategies we could try doing is try doing more work per pass through the loop. So let's look at what that might look like. Here is, let's just for comparison, old code, new code, old code, new code. I have added one line right here and changed the increment here. What would this look like in the C? Exactly, right? So I add up sum of I and sum of I plus 1, and I do I plus equals 2. I'm doing 2 things at a time. This is, now I have a 6 instruction loop, 2 of which are work. So I went from 1/5 of my loop is work to now 1/3 of my loop is work. This is going to be more efficient. Okay? And this process is called loop unrolling. Loop unrolling is this notion that sometimes my loop is spending too much time on the loop management and not enough time doing the work. And so I'm going to duplicate the work and go in larger increments. Now, there's a challenge I have. I mentioned for caching, you have to handle the leftovers. You have to handle the leftovers here for loop unrolling too. If it turns out that I didn't end up at the end of the loop, then I need to handle whatever's left. So I have this extra kind of step at the end to handle whatever's left. But as long as my size is pretty big, this is going to give me a fairly dramatic savings. I would expect on order of 3/5 of the time of the previous loop. Because I'm doing one piece of work per 3 instructions instead of one piece of work per 5 instructions overall. And of course, there's no limit. I don't have to stop at 2. I could do 4. Or any other number I happen to pick. It doesn't really matter. Oh, I have a typo here. This should be size. Not that I'm actually running this code, but all right. I can pick any number. It doesn't need to be a multiple of anything in particular. I just decide how much am I incrementing, and then I just copy the loop body, changing that base inside. And so now this code, if we think about it, it's still going to have 4 instructions of loop overhead plus 4 instructions of work. So I expect this to be spending half of its time doing work and thus be 5/2, so 2.5 times faster than my original version, will be my baseline expectation. Questions about this strategy? Yes?
Do you expect
Great question. Do I need a minimum size for input ray? I actually have a typo in this code that is based on that. What's the typo in this code? This might get too big. That should be I plus 3 is less than size. How many should be I plus 3? Because that's the biggest index I'm using. And if I do that, no, I know I don't need to have a minimum size. Now, this may not be efficient. If my size was 3, that first loop won't run at all, and then my second loop will just run linearly. Right? And that's not the best possible outcome. I'm checking a loop I don't need to. But I almost never need to optimize for small things. Small things run quickly. It's the big things that take all the time. So I want to optimize for the really big arrays. Other questions? Okay. So we have this idea. This is a technique we can use whenever we want. When is it most effective? It's most effective when the work being done in the loop is very fast. If the work being done in the loop was already 20 instructions, then the loop overhead would have already been a small percentage of the loop's work. And loop unrolling would do relatively little. The simpler the work inside the loop is, the more the loop overhead dominates the total loop runtime, and the more loop unrolling will give me benefit. There is a downside to unrolling. If I unroll too much, my code will get slower, even if I don't have to worry about the wrong sizes. Why might my code get slower if I unrolled too much? Yeah?
I'm guessing you would have a lot of instructions in your code. The code would get very big, so it takes a lot of time to access those instructions.
Right. I have a lot of instructions, making my code very big, meaning my instruction cache would fill up. Right? And I might start getting instruction cache misses loading the code into memory, which might slow down my operation. And my instruction cache then competes with other things, so this may have impacts sort of earlier than you'd expect, depending on what else happens to be in my instruction cache elsewhere. So the bigger my code is, the more instruction cache I take up, the more likely I am to evict some piece of code I'm about to see next, or evict my own code. And so I don't want giant code. There's a penalty to big code. In general, that penalty comes at a fairly large size, but we'll start seeing that at some point. All right. This is some timing that Professor Rice performed on this code. I have a table here, the level of unrolling. How many times did we replicate the internal value? He also made sure he ran this on a small enough instance and fit entirely in his L1 cache. And he has two extra values here. The number of cycles we do per element of the array. That was that thing I said should be 5 initially and then drop down. It turns out that's lower. We have the number of instructions per element. This should be the same thing, but it's not. So let's explore these numbers. Let's start with the cycles per element. The cycles per element here is just one lower than we expected. The compiler manages to turn the 4 overhead into 3 when it actually reaches the hardware. It actually does this by combining two of the steps. So it turns out under the hood, it does the compare and the jump as one thing by translating the code we give it in the hardware. We'll talk some more about how that might happen probably on Thursday. So it has 3 instructions of loop overhead, 1 instruction of work. And so for this first thing, I expect it to be 4 instructions per element of the loop. Then I have 5 instructions per 2, which is 2.5. Then I have 6 instructions per, 4 instructions per 1, 5 instructions per 2. Then I have 7 instructions per 4, which gives me this number, and so on down the list, right? This is going to be 11 instructions per 8. And that's what this column is. I've got a little bit of fuzz because there was a little bit of overhead for the loop as a whole. It was a big array, but it wasn't a gargantuan array, so I have this tiny little overhead on top. But this is what's going on here. This is what we expect to see. When we look at the actual timing code, how many clock cycles does it take to work? The numbers are not lining up. First, notice that somehow it managed to do 4 instructions in 1 1/3 cycle. Huh? And then, for some reason, that then very quickly turns into it's doing basically just flat. It does one cycle per element, regardless of how much I unroll, which is just strange. right? We're hitting some sort of bound. We have more than one instruction being operated per cycle, somehow, and we're ending up running out of time somehow. And so let's explore how this happens. What's going on here? This isn't where I want to be next, is it? All right. So, let's explore some things about our... You know what? Before we... No, we'll skip that. We'll come back to this. All right. There are two things your hardware can do that we haven't talked about yet. Let's talk about both of them. First is multiple issue. Multiple issue is the idea that basically we make a complete duplicate of our pipeline. We make two fetch pieces of logic, two memory, two and so forth. Each of the things we're just going to have multiple of. It's going to be slightly more complicated this when we implement it in practice, but this is the basic idea. And so when I read instructions, I'm going to read two instructions, and if possible, I'm going to run them both at once. This is the idea of multiple issue. I basically just put multiple computers inside your computer. I put them on the same chip, which will allow me to do various things if there's dependencies between them. Okay? So for example, you'll notice that these two instructions both need register 11, and so they are actually forwarding between here, right? The execute stage here is forwarding down to the next execute stage in the standard way we've talked about before. This makes our logic more complicated because we have more possible paths to consider. But beside the extra complexity, we could just get more power. We can do more things at once. The other thing we can do is execute things out of order. So we've been talking about caches. Caches mean that the memory stage takes a variable number of cycles. How do we make that happen? Let's imagine that somehow the memory stage itself can tell us when it's done. How exactly we'll get to that, we'll get a little later. But we're going to assume that we can just tell it when it's done. So when I do a memory register move, it may say, I need 3 cycles of memory. Where the other things that need no don't have memory may need 0 cycles of memory. And the idea of out of order, you'll notice this is not multiple issue, it's single issue, but the out of order is when I come to an instruction like subtraction here, that's waiting for my memory to handle. It can't proceed. So it has to stall. While it is stalling, let's go ahead and see if we can do the next thing. This is going to have to make our stalling more complicated. We can't sort of stall it in the pipeline stage. We'll have to stall it somewhere else. So we need to use that pipeline stage to do the next thing that didn't depend on it. So we'll go ahead and fetch our third instruction while our second instruction is waiting off in some sort of side area. We'll go ahead and finish running that and then run the instruction after that before bringing the stalled instruction back in because its data is available. Running things out of order involves some complexities in the hardware that we'll talk about today and Thursday, probably mostly Thursday given the time. But we also have to make sure that the end result doesn't show it. So you'll notice that the fetches that happen in order, and we have this special C stage, the commit stage. Once we finish operating on one of these things we finished too soon, we're just going to hold on to its value until everything before it finished. And we need to do that hold on because we don't want a later instruction to be overwritten by an earlier instruction. So whatever final effect they have has to happen in the order they were specified in the code. So we'll fetch them in the order they show up in the code, we'll commit them in the order in the code, but we'll do the work in whatever order works, whatever order we have available resources to. And so most modern processors today are both multiple issue and out of order. They'll fetch several instructions at once, they'll handle them however they can, they'll hold on to the values to make sure they put them back out in order, so you get the illusion of everything running in order. But the end result is we can do things several instructions at a time, and we can also not be as slowed down when something goes wrong if there's some other useful work to do. And that is how we end up getting, in this first example, doing four instructions in one and a third cycles. Or in other words, three instructions per cycle. We're loading, it turns out we're loading four instructions and then some of them are stalling. We're ending up finishing three instructions each cycle as we're running through our loop. But that extra overhead is being blocked by something for these others. We're not continuing to get that utilization. In fact, the more we unroll, the less instructions we are completing at a time. Because we just hit this one cycle per element bound and we stay there. The name your textbook gives for this is the latency bound. There is going to be some data dependency that is going to cause this latency in our overall operation because of the way we wrote our code. We have to wait for one thing to finish before we can do the next thing, and there's going to be some sort of pipeline through that, some path through that that's going to block everything else, and everything's going to have to wait for that sequence. And we'll explain how that happens as we move forward. Questions? Yes?
From these numbers, what is like most optimal? Or can we, based off of these numbers, can we tell like what amount of unrolling is the maximum?
Great question. What's the most optimal unrolling? When I am optimizing my code, the thing I care about is time. Wall clock time. So the cycles is the column I care about. So according to this code, does it matter how many levels of unrolling I do? Basically, no. As long as I do at least one, I'm good. But when we hit something that shows us we clearly could get more utilization, but we're not, that suggests there's going to be some other optimization we can add on top. So we're not having caching problems. Once we've unrolled, we're no longer being blocked by our loop overhead. We're still being blocked by something. There's something that's causing this latency bound. If we can figure out what that is and fix that, then our further unrolling might give us more benefit on top of this. Yes?
The latency bound is the point where unrolling no longer helps.
Mm-hmm. It can be show up in other ways, but that's a common way of seeing it. The latency bound is where the unrolling stops working. Yes? It's going to be based on data dependencies. So, yeah, let's actually let's look back at our code. Actually, let's go all the way back to our assembly because I think it'll be a little clearer here. Notice that RAX is needed in every add. So I have, as written, I have to do the adds in order. And even if I'm able to do a bunch of adds at once, I can't do a bunch of adds at once because they all depend on the previous one's result. And so unless I could somehow do sequential adds in less than a cycle, which is not the meaning of cycle, I'm sort of stuck at most one. And so we're going to have to do something to free that up in order to get more performance out of this. If my work was multiple cycles, then that dependency may still mean more unrolling could help me. Right? And we think this more unrolling should help us anyway. The only reason it doesn't is because we actually have this multiple issue. So we're dealing the whole loop overhead sort of in parallel with doing our work in different parts, sort of parallel pipelines. Which means that after a single level of loop unrolling, or I guess to two at works per step, we're already hitting as efficient as we can be. Other questions? Yes? Is it like using multiple cores? It is vaguely, but there's several important differences. Let's look at one important difference. Multiple cores have their own registers. They have their own cache, L1 cache. They operate like separate computers. There is no way that I could run subQ and XOR Q on different cores, because they have a data dependency. They both depend on R11. Right? So if I had them on separate cores, I would have to run subQ and then saying, I'm done, send a message over to the other core, here's my answer, and then it would have to start its work. So I can have a great deal more sort of interconnectedness of behavior, which for things like executing this code is very desirable. For other things, if I wanted things to look like they're actually on separate processes and don't share, less desirable. So we're actually going to almost always have both. We'll have multiple cores that act like completely separate processes, have separate variables, separate registers, separate everything. And we'll also have multiple issues per core so they can each do several instructions at a time. Yes?
How can one CPU fetch two instructions at once?
How do you fetch two instructions at once? You just grab more bytes.
Do you only have one pipeline register?
No, we're going to throw registers at our computer like they were candy. I mean, we're going to have thousands of registers. So the pipeline register, sure, I mean, if you think about the pipeline register bank, we can say there's one. But it can have multiple instructions, multiple destinations and sources and so forth, all in that giant bank. And in practice, actually, it turns out that a lot of current processors have four fetches. And so we'll have four complete copies of everything you need to run four separate instructions all in that giant register bank at each stage of our pipeline. Yeah?
To clarify, we're saying that, like, oh, a given computer has multiple cores and each core has multiple issues?
Yep. Okay. That is correct. And if you get a high-end machine, you might have multiple processors with multiple cores, each with multiple issue. Right? So it keeps getting bigger. Other questions? Yes?
For the out-of-order instructions here, is there a reason why there are no memory stages for the instructions?
Yeah, so I have a variable length memory stage. So I figure out how much I need to spend in memory, and since I have the overhead, I have the mechanism to make it variable length, I can make it zero. So I can just check the I code and say, I don't need memory for this instruction, and just skip over it. Once I have the mechanism to be able to stay one or three or 50 stages in memory, I can also do zero just as easily. Other questions? Yes? The commit puts it actually back into the register file, back into actual memory, and makes it visible outside of our process. So the idea here is that between fetch and between the first and last stage, I'm only working in forwarding. Everything's stored in the pipeline somewhere. I'm moving it around as I need it. But none of it's actually made it back out sort of that more permanent place. And I need to make sure that it goes back out in the permanent place in the same order the programmer asked it to. Otherwise, we might end up overwriting an earlier value with a later value. So, for example, if we said, this won't quite work, but right, if one of our destinations here, if we added an IR move queue, putting 1 into R9, if I didn't have a commit stage, I could fetch, decode, oh, didn't mean to do that. I could fetch, decode, execute, write back, commit. If I didn't have to worry about putting that in order, I would write R9 here before I wrote it here. And I end up with the wrong value of R9 in my register file. I could try to do some sort of dependency and say it goes there, but it's going to be easier for our purposes just to say it goes in order. Yes? Nope. Latency bound is caused by a data dependency, not by the commit. Yes? Yes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about register renaming, which I don't think we'll get to today. Other questions? Yes?
Are we going to go through like some like, example exercises on like the concepts that we went over today?
Example exercises on the concepts we went over today. I don't have particular examples here. I guess I don't know what to do. You will have assignments and quizzes and so on for it, but the things we've actually talked about doing so far are unrolling and then cache blocking. And I guess I don't know what to do for an example exercise for that. On Thursday, we will talk more about how this hardware stuff works, and we will go through some examples, exercises for that in class. Yes? So out of order can cause me to have higher utilization of my processor. Okay, so note here, if I did not have out of order, then I wouldn't be able to even start this third instruction until down here. Right? And so the total latency of this instruction set would increase. So overall allows me to have more of my processor working more of the time and finish sequences of instructions more quickly. Yes?
Can you combine the two?
Yes, real processors are both multiple issue and out of order. I have them listed separately here to try to keep it from being too overwhelming. All right. Let me come back to these things I missed, which I guess are sort of like the exercises alluded to. Here I have 3 bits of code. Okay. I have my reference code up top, which is the code the other two are based to look like. And it is doing an operation that you're fairly familiar with by now, I think. And then I have 2 subsequent pieces of code. This first one is doing blocking. Notice I'm going up by k, then I have my j loop, then I have k again, and then I'm doing my work. This second one is unrolling and blocking. So the third piece of code is identical to the second piece of code, fully unrolled. I took this inner loop, which was running twice. Right, it was running for kk and kk plus 1. And I just wrote those two cases out directly. Except I didn't write it quite correctly because I forgot one of these. And so this is actually a fairly common thing to do. I will block to get cache performance. I will unroll to get better loop access. If I can unroll all the way, then I have no loop overhead, which is so much better than just having less loop overhead. And so it's fairly common to see in optimized code blocking and unrolling, possibly complete or total unrolling of our loop until the loop overhead just vanishes and I just have every iteration written out explicitly. And this will get me both the caching benefits of blocking, although fairly small in this case, and some of the performance benefits of unrolling. Yes? Where? In this place? I meant K. In the third piece of code. I meant... Sorry, you're right. I changed them all into Ks instead of KKs. Let's be consistent here instead. That'll work. I think I'll more closely match the run above it. So I just unrolled the K loop by putting its 2 iterations directly. So, we can do this. All right. Let's just close out with a little, oops, too many semicolons. I don't know why I did that. Let's close out by looking at these pieces of code. So both of these are doing some sort of unrolling. Let's say version A and version B both have 2 instructions inside the inner loop. One of them is also doing cache blocking. The other is not. Which one is doing cache blocking?
A.
We have a vote for A. Any votes for B? We have a vote for B. We have another vote for B. We have another vote for A. Oh dear, so many votes. All right. How How do we know? Yeah. Okay. So because our I is being multiplied by N, maybe it's A? Remember, cache blocking will change the order of memory accesses. So an easy way to tell if we have achieved some sort of cache blocking is to see, do I access memory in different order? This first one, A accesses index 0, 1, and 2, in that order. This one accesses memory 0, 1, and 2. This one accesses 0, 1, and N. So B has changed the order of memory accesses. Whether this will actually make things faster or not depends if I change them in a useful way. But B has changed the order of memory accesses, A has not. And so B is a candidate for cache blocking where A is not. This, I believe, is the time we have today. I will see you all on Thursday.